Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
There is a place where time stands still, where nature is harsh and demanding, where only the quick and the strong and the deadly can survive. This place is no place for civilized man.
I want my land.
Kick it in the guts, Barry. Far away from my home.
All you've got to do now is pass the Australian culture test. Three simple questions, three correct answers,
did you get all this
and
together?
You go through that doorway to the greatest little country in the world.
The glass is made of yards of ivory chest.
Good morning, everybody. This is Annie, and I have to admit that my voice is struggling a bit today because I got a lurgy when I went overseas, but I had to come back on my first day back from Showreel, and today I have the great honour of talking to James Ricketson. Now, James Ricketson is a very well-known independent filmmaker. He is well-known for a film called Blackfellas, but the reason why we're talking to him today is because he was there when the police rioted on Monday in Sydney, and we would like to get a filmmaker's perspective on that particular debacle. G'day, James. How are you?
Good morning. Now, who am I speaking to?
My name's Annie McLaughlin, and I'm from 3CR, and this is Showreel. And the reason why I'm talking to you is because I read a post about your experiences on Monday in Sydney when you went as a upstanding member of society to say that inviting a genocidist to Australia is really not on. Can you tell my listeners why you went there?
Well, I went there because I'm opposed to the genocide that's taking place in Gaza. I went there to join with a lot of other people, and I'm getting very bad feedback. Is that from your end or my end?
I don't know, but it's okay. We're hearing you clearly.
Okay, what I might do is I'm in a cafe. I might just walk out into the street so that I don't annoy other people.
Thank you.
So I went along as someone who's opposed to the genocide and as somebody who believes that President Herzog should not have been invited to the country and not been given a platform to conflate anti-Israel with anti-Zionism.
Hello?
The time that I was holding read, I'm not anti-Semitic, I'm anti-genocide. And I think that there's a lot of people who feel exactly the same way. They've got nothing at all against Jews, nothing at all against that particular religion, but they do have an objection to the Netanyahu government and its treatment of the people of Palestine in Gaza and on the West Bank.
Now, we've been told that there is a core group of activists, the rally that happened on Monday in Sydney was far greater than, say, a core group of activists. This was a general response, wasn't it?
Well, it was. I'm not very good at judging numbers, and I'm not sure if somebody has guessed how many people were there. But it was jam packed. The whole area around the town hall was jam packed with people, and there were lots of people on the side streets who couldn't actually get in because it was too crowded. But if Premier Minns and Anthony Albanese had read the room properly, they would have seen that back in 6 months or so ago, when there was the big walk on the Harbour Bridge and many other walks in different parts of Australia, that the issue of Palestine is one of great importance to a lot of Australians. And so, as far as I could tell, from what I saw, there were lots of people from all different walks of life, of all different nationalities, who were there peacefully demonstrating and expressing their concern with the government's invitation to Herzog to come to Australia. There were speakers set up outside the town hall, but I couldn't hear anything that was coming through the speakers. But there were lots of people there, and there was lots of shouting and cheering, and a few chants and so on. And then after about an hour and a half, the energy went out of the demonstration, and people began to drift off. And I began to drift off. I walked in a northerly direction along George Street, alongside the town hall. For those of you who know the geography, towards the Queen Victoria Building. And there was a wall of policemen backed up by police officers on horses. They said to me, you can't go this way. I said, I'm just going to the railway station. You can't go this way, mate. And you've got to go walk up the other, go round the other way. Now, in the meantime, there were a lot of people who were trying to leave the demonstration, who were also heading in a northerly direction. The police turned them back and said, no, you've got to go back the other way. So they then got forced into a limited space with the other people who were trying to turn north. Some scuffles broke out, and then it was all on for young and old. I was just sitting on the wall. The next thing I knew was I was pushed from behind. It all happened so fast, I didn't really know who'd pushed me, but I turned around and pushed the person who'd pushed me, and it turned out to be a police officer. And the next thing I know, I'm lying on the ground with about half a dozen police officers on top of me, hitting me, kneeling on my neck, kneeling on my head, pulling my arms out from underneath my body so they could handcuff me with those hog tie things that they use, and in the process causing a severe laceration to my right elbow and a minor one to my left elbow. And I was told that I was under arrest for assaulting a police officer, taken to a police station, the Sydney Police Centre, put into a cell. I was actually assaulted while I was in jail by a police officer. Not seriously, but it was obvious from the context that it's par for the course. Once you're inside the police station, you're fair game. If someone wants to have a go at you physically, they can. Anyhow, then 5 hours later, I was released because they'd looked at the body cam footage of the policeman who I supposedly, allegedly assaulted, realised that I hadn't assaulted him at all. I was released. I was never charged formally. I wasn't fingerprinted. I wasn't photographed. I didn't have to sign any documents to get my personal possessions back. I was just kind of pushed out the front door and told to go home. Now, in the meantime, while I was in custody, I was bleeding quite badly, and I left quite a bit of blood on the bench of the cell that I was in. No one said, do you need some medical attention? No one said, would you like a glass of water? No one said, would you like something to eat? Would you like to use the bathroom? I was treated, I suspect, the way... because they had no idea who I was. As far as they were concerned, I was just some old man, you know, who could be treated in whatever way they liked. And I was treated badly, and it made me realise how other people that don't have access to the radio, as I have now, access to the media because I'm involved in the media, people who have no access are fair game for whatever the cops want to meet out.
Yeah.
That's it in a nutshell.
Yeah, I know. And as you said, you're 70, so... and
76, yeah.
Oh, 76. We're hearing stories of exactly the same thing. I mean, the footage of the police running... I mean, there's a bare space, and then there's this huge phalanx of police running at people. And then the Minns government stands up and says... oh, the activists were violent. And you sort of think,
I know.
It's so weird.
The thing is, I think that what happened was because, I think I mentioned already, that the police had been perfectly calm and reasonable and not at all aggressive. I had a couple of conversations with the police. They were fine. But then it suddenly, once the demonstration was over and there'd been no confrontation at all at that point, nothing at all, I think that there was a message that was sent from somewhere higher up in the hierarchy, either from Premier Minns or from the Commissioner of Police, to create chaos so there could be some violence so that they could retrospectively justify having all of those policemen there and have a reason not to allow demonstrations to happen in the future. I think that was all that was all planned. And I'm hoping that when there's an independent investigation, that they figure out who it was that actually gave the order to the police that enabled them to basically do whatever they liked.
Well, someone was talking about their experience as a 78er with the violent police reactions to gay rights activists in King's Cross in 1978. And they were in the same, they were at the rally on Monday, but they were talking about how, you know, it was actually highly traumatic because it brought back those experiences for him. But he was also saying that the theatre of it was different in the sense that the police are now being militarised. Did you get an impression of that?
Well, the police, I mean, it used to be when I was young, because I'm 76, so, and I was at the Springboks demonstrations, anti-Vietnam War demonstrations and so on. And back then the police just wore blue uniforms. They didn't have weapons. They weren't weaponized in any way at all. They weren't particularly threatening, actually. And I got on well mostly with the police. And I mean, just to use an example, which will probably be familiar to people of kind of my age and even younger, is that if you got pulled over by the police back then because your rego had run out a week beforehand, or if you'd forgotten to turn your lights off while you were driving down the street, the policeman would say to you, "Hey, mate, you know, you realise that your rego ran out a week ago? Oh, shit, did it? I didn't realise. Yeah, look, you better get it fixed up quickly, OK? Or you realise that you've got to turn your lights on." None of that happens now. The police, and I've had a couple of experiences with this, the first thing that the police do is speak to you and act towards you in an aggressive fashion. That's part of the course now, which is a real pity because it means that people who have that kind of encounter with a policeman wind up hating the police or feeling antagonistic towards the police, whereas it should be that the police, unless you're a criminal and doing something wrong, they should just be seen as people, members of the community who are there to protect all of us from the bad deeds of people who do bad deeds. the whole relationship with the police has changed in the last 30, 40 years, and it hasn't changed for the better.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's been my experience as well. I always take most of this with a grain of salt, but I must say the footage that came out on social media, which was raw footage of people's experience on the day, seemed to be pretty clear of what actually happened. But also the police being so pumped up that in some cases, like in your case, a large amount of them jumping on top of you. But there's actually a person who's prone on the ground, been already handcuffed, and a policeman is belting them on both sides of their ribs, you know, and in their neck and their head.
Well, I've got a very tender area underneath my right hand ribs. So yes, but one of the things that I'm fortunate in is that because I'm 76 years old, if when they threw me to the ground, I'd landed on my hip and broken my hip.
Yeah.
For a 76-year-old man, a broken hip can be a death sentence, basically.
Yeah.
And there were some other people that were kind of around my age that were treated in that way. One woman who had her back broken in four places.
That's right, yeah.
And it's kind of a miracle in a way that I wasn't more severely hurt than I was. And I suspect that if this happens again, someone will die, you know? And so my recommendation is that there needs to be an independent investigation to determine exactly what went wrong, who gave the orders to free the police up to do whatever they liked, And where do we go from here? Because we don't want to replicate what's happened in the United States with ICE. That would be a disaster in a country like Australia. We need to get back to a kind of a civil way of dealing with demonstrations in which the protesters treat the police with respect and the police treat the protesters with respect.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, that the particular message of the protesters was basically being the state, as it's been represented now, was saying to everybody, you're not allowed to express this opinion.
Sorry, I missed that last bit.
Well, the idea that the demonstrators standing there saying that inviting a war criminal or an indictable person to the country in this manner and then parading them around and taking them to Parliament in Canberra. Now they're down here in Victoria in Melbourne today and being lauded. There's people standing there saying, like, we find this abhorrent that we're...
It is abhorrent. It was a very bad call on the part of Minns and on the part of Albanese. And as I think I already mentioned, if they'd looked at the Sydney Harbour Bridge walk and the equivalents that happened in Melbourne, they would know that the community, the Australian community, feels very strongly about this, and you'd be very careful about who you invite to the country.
Yeah.
You certainly don't invite someone who's the president of a country that's engaged and has been found guilty of practicing genocide in Gaza.
It's all us on end, really. I just remind my listeners, you're on 3CR, this is Showreel, and we're talking to filmmaker James Ricketson, who was at the rally in Sydney when the police rioted on Monday. Let's go a little bit to some of your filmmaking experiences. When you made Blackfellas, I guess that was also an experience of investigating particular types of attitudes within the Australian community, which mainly the mainstream really found a little bit unsettling.
Well, look, what happened was that back in 1982, 83, I directed the first episode of a series called Women of the Sun.
Yep, I remember that.
Which was produced by Bob Weiss, who's in Melbourne and might even be listening now. And that was a groundbreaking production because it was looking at four stories from Australia's history from the point of view of the Aboriginal people themselves. So I made the first episode. The series did very well. It was very popular. And then quite a few years later, somebody recommended that I read a book called Day of the Dog by Archie Weller. I read it. Made contact with Archie and said, look, I'd really love to make a film of this if that's okay, if you want me to do it. He said, well, already there's an Aboriginal filmmaker who's got the rights to it. And I said, okay, well, look, if it ever transpires that the rights revert to you, I'd definitely be interested. And then a couple of years later, the Aboriginal filmmaker was not able to get any interest in it at all. So I sat down with Archie. And we started writing, and we did a couple of drafts together, and then I took over and kind of did drafts myself. Nobody wanted to make the film because they thought it was depressing, because it was about young Aboriginals that steal cars and take drugs and get drunk and everything. So I had no success at all in getting anybody interested in it, but I kept going. Eventually, I produced a script that everybody liked, and the film was funded. And... this was 1992 or something. And that was before there was a huge influx of money put into Aboriginal filmmaking. So here was me, a white fella, making a film about blackfellas in Western Australia. But it wasn't an issue for anybody at all that I was doing that. And it wasn't until the film was completed and about a year later that some people in the Aboriginal community and some people in the non-Aboriginal community also thought it was completely inappropriate for a white guy to have made the film, which actually won some awards. But then what happened was that a lot of money was put into Aboriginal filmmaking, and very successfully so. There's been a lot of really wonderful films made by Aboriginals about Aboriginal stories for Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal Australians to view, and it's been terrific. I think it's one of the best things that our industry has done, you know, in the last 50 years. Anyhow, so that's in brief how Blackfellas came into being.
And I guess that that experience of making that film, were you, what attracted you to the subject? Because, like you said, it's taken a lot of work for Aboriginal filmmakers to get their hands on the cameras, doesn't it? Hasn't it?
Well, it did back then. Now it's not very difficult at all now for Aboriginal filmmakers. It was difficult back then, but what attracted me to the story was that it was about a marginalised group of Australians that very rarely got to tell their own stories. And the original story was written by Archie Weller, who identified as Aboriginal and had been an integral part of the Aboriginal community ever since he was a little boy. And about 10 years after Blackfellas was completed, some people in the Aboriginal community decided that Archie wasn't a real Aboriginal at all, so he got kind of ostracised by quite a few people. But he'd grown up with Aboriginals, and the story rings true, and the story was much loved by the Aboriginal community, the Noongar community in Perth. And so, I mean, that opens up a whole Pandora's box of questions about who has the right to tell what stories. And my argument back then, and my argument today, would be if some Aboriginal person wanted to make a comedy about white people that live in the eastern suburbs of Sydney, I think they should be able to do it.
That would be great.
Yeah, you know, and it'd be a comedy too, because Blackfellas have got a great sense of humour.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You've also had other sort of... obviously your filmmaking, you've got a philosophy around what's worth making a film. I mean, it would have been great if you'd had a camera on Monday night, I'd say. But you also have explored other... I mean, I was interested in that... this film you made called Third Person Plural, which you said you didn't like anymore, but it was an interesting experiment, wasn't it?
Well, it was an experiment. I made the film for $35,000, a feature film, and it was an experiment, and at the time, I was hoping that I would have the opportunity to make three or four films like that, very low budget, just trying different ideas out, but it didn't work out that way. So it doesn't really reflect everything that I wanted to do back then. I'm not ashamed of it or anything.
No,
like
but
that.
The methodology was interesting, wasn't it? It was this collaboration with the actors.
In collaboration with the actors, and it was all shot handheld, with no lights. It was kind of approaching filmmaking the way Lars von Trier did, you know, later. Yeah. I mean, I did that before Lars von Trier.
Yeah, no, that's what I was thinking. How extraordinary.
The atmosphere back then, because there was a lot of 10BA money around, and that wasn't the kind of filmmaking that the industry wanted to explore.
Well, you know, it starred Brian Brown, and it was made in 1978, so if anybody's interested, they should go and have a look at it.
Well, if you can find it, I don't know where you can find it. I don't even have a copy myself anymore.
Oh, right.
It'll probably be in the National Library, I hope so, anyway.
Yeah, well, I thought that was pretty interesting. But then you also, your political activism took you to Cambodia, which you became a bit notorious, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. And look, I must go in a second because I wasn't really anticipating this call. And I'm actually in the process of writing letters to people about what happened on Monday.
Oh, well, maybe I should let you go.
I went to Cambodia. I made a film about child prostitution and street kids called Sleeping with Cambodia. I got caught up in the life of the little girl that was the star of the film. I'm still caught up in her life now, 30 years later, and she's the mother of 11 children.
Oh.
And I got into trouble in Cambodia because two of her children were kidnapped by a Christian church, an Australian NGO. I got stuck into that NGO and into other NGOs that were stealing children from their families and using them to raise money. For their NGO, which was very common back then. And I ran afoul of the NGO community, and that, in a very roundabout way, led to me being arrested, charged with being a spy, and spending 15 months in a maximum security third world prison in a cell with 140 others, a cell about three quarters of the size of a tennis court. So we're all jammed in like sardines. So that was definitely an interesting experience.
Thanks for talking to me, James.
Okay, I'm sorry I can't talk any longer, but I've got a busy morning.
Are you a current 3CR subscriber? Your membership helps us stay true to our community values.
It enables us to produce over 100 local shows each week, train and support new volunteers and broadcasters, and maintain our transmission technology.
Your subscription helps us cover issues important to you, like public housing, First Nations justice, community languages,
advocacy for Palestine, celebrating queer and trans communities, and bringing you the best of local independent music.
As we head into our 50th year of broadcasting, your ongoing subscription is as vital to the station today as it was for those subscribing in 1976.
Help to keep 3CR unique by becoming a subscriber today.
Go to 3cr.org.au or call 03 9419 8377.
That's it for Showreel this week. Very interesting stuff. We were talking to James Ricketson, filmmaker. Coming up next is Published or Not.
On a narrow gauge, by a spider light, one candle burns below her man. Are you hammered and tired, gleaner in hand, fuse too short to run fast in? Oh, barrow boys, with your candles too, a tallow way out to leave this realm. In a furnace blast, air hotter than hell, now a ruin of ash and shards. This seem no daydream, dream for some but not me. This seem no daydream, dream for some but not me. By the bullock drays, in the blistering sun, carry silver bullion, fortunes for Melbourne. Smelters up on the hill, now a ruin of hell, with your crucible tombs and tears so leaden. Umber, umber car, with your waters of gold, all will never slake thirst, but drives a fever. Umber, umber car, with your waters of gold, all will never slake thirst, or heal a sad heart.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au. You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.